All right, for our final segment today on the program, I'm going to go it alone. And returning to that book, Duh, which I mentioned in our first segment by Bob Fenster, it had a wonderful quote in it from Henry VI of France, the King of France at one point, during which time a pompous French dignitary was making a windy speech, a braying donkey evidently interrupted. To which said the king, "Gentlemen, one at a time, please." And speaking of braying jackasses in modern America, the Reverend Jerry Falwell has spoken up to put forward the proposition that rigid religious fundamentalism is wrong, at least when it's of the Muslim kind. His own brand of narrow-minded bigotry is something to feed to the media for wide dissemination. Falwell said on CBS a few days back that while Jesus and Moses set examples for love, Muhammad did the opposite. The prophet of Islam, he said, was a violent man, a man of war, a terrorist. Falwell's remarks were immediately condemned by the Board of America's Council of Churches, which labeled his remarks, quote, "not Christian and shockingly uninformed," unquote. The Jerusalem Post, which I think most people would agree it's hard to accuse them of a pro-Islamic bias, reported that the Anti-Defamation League said that Falwell owes an apology to the millions of good people who follow the Muslim faith. Now, on the other hand, Pat Robertson spoke up on his 700 Club to cite the fact that a letter written in Pakistan urged a religious edict or death sentence against Falwell, like against a Salman Rushdie. "This proves," said Robertson, "that Islam is a violent religion." "Gentlemen, one at a time, please." Riots immediately ensued in India, with five people being killed. So it seems to me this might be a good time to explain to you, the listening public, just how stupid certain right-wing so-called religious leaders are in this country. We plan to tell you the story of the Crusades either next week or the week after. That's something that's spurred on more by stupid politicians. For example, when the Bush administration called for a crusade against Osama bin Laden, they obviously in the administration didn't know their history, because there's few things that would unite Muslims against the West quite like a reference to the Crusades, with very good reason, as we'll explain to you in the weeks to come. But today, let's stick to the issue of Muhammad and just who this guy was. A truly remarkable man, though probably fewer than one American in 20, I imagine, could tell you three facts about him. And in such an area of wide ignorance, this bigotry by people like Falwell can thrive. So we think it's worthwhile taking 10 or 12 minutes to shed some light on this topic. Now, among the people professing to be Muslims are bloodthirsty fanatics. Now, exactly the same thing is true among people who profess to be Christians and Jews. Islam holds no monopoly at all on ignorant cranks willing to shed blood for their twisted ideas. But to call Muhammad a terrorist is to stoop very low. Muhammad did find himself at one point in his career leading an army. But military men are not necessarily promoters of terror. Would you call Dwight Eisenhower a terrorist? I think you'd have to be very ignorant to do something like that. And if you did, you probably wouldn't get reported on CBS. Now, in future shows, we're going to talk to scientist author Michael Hart about William Shakespeare. He wrote a book called The 100 that attempted to assess the most influential persons in history. Great book. We'd recommend it highly to any of you out there in the listening audience to snag a copy. It's available in most bookstores. Hart set out to establish a criteria for influence. Hart is not a historian. He's a scientist, but he set aside some criteria that makes for very interesting reading. He set out to try and assess whose absence would leave the biggest void, who changed the course of human events most dramatically. Now, James Watson and Francis Crick made a great discovery in 1953, deciphering the structure of DNA. They wouldn't rank on Hart's list, because if they hadn't gotten it, Linus Pauling would have. In fact, if you've ever read the great book, The Double Helix, you know they barely beat Pauling to the Nobel Prize on that one. The Wright brothers were something different. They were miles ahead of the competition, and flight was surely greatly accelerated by those bicycle makers out from Ohio. We probably would have flown one way or the other sooner or later, but the Wright brothers did accelerate things far ahead of what probably would have happened under more normal circumstances. The highest marks in Hart's book went to truly original thinkers. His top 10 included 6 religious leaders and the 2 greatest scientists who ever lived. Now, the top man, per Michael Hart, and it's a position that I find hard to fault, is Muhammad, the founder of the world's 2nd largest religion, that of Islam. Had there been no Muhammad, the world's 1 billion Muslims would surely be leading much different lives today. The fun part of the book is, you know, just seeing his reasoning and arguing and learning about, you know, who really made a difference throughout history. One might care to dispute Muhammad's position atop the list. Some would argue that Jesus of Nazareth might be given a more prominent position than 3rd, which he earns on the list. But Hart's argument is that Christianity is more properly seen as having 2 founders, Jesus and St. Paul. St. Paul's contribution to what we think of as today's Christian churches is probably exceeds that of Jesus, almost ranks him as a co-founder when it comes to Christianity. With Islam, there's no such division. It all came down to the actions of Muhammad. Now, whether he's 1 or something less than that, I don't think anybody could deny who studies history that between the fall of Rome and the Renaissance, the most singular figure in world history was the Prophet of Islam. So he's certainly worth a few minutes today. Muhammad was born in or near the year 570, far from the world centers of culture. It was in a backwater, Western Arabia. The natives of Arabia, Arabs, had produced a few centers of modest wealth. One was in Petra, in today's Jordan, which I had the pleasure of visiting a couple years ago. Marvelous city out in the desert, made wealthy by trade. But there were no great cities in Arabia. There was Yathrib, a nearby town and agricultural community. There was Mecca, a trading town where semi-nomads passed through on the caravan routes with a lot of money earned through trade. Was the commercial hub of the Arabian Peninsula. And that's where Muhammad was born. We don't know much about his early life, which is, of course, much the case with Jesus. And like Jesus, the exact date of his birth is uncertain. Most people think it's 570 or 571. Born in Mecca, he was orphaned around age 6. His family was of modest means. They belonged to a tribe of traders, though not to its most wealthy or influential portion of the family. Mecca depended on trading, as I said, for its income. It had a sanctuary, the Kaaba, filled with images of the local gods. Muhammad's family trading connections evidently extended as far north as Syria and down towards Yemen at the tip of the Arabian Peninsula. He had a fairly uneventful life early on. At age 25, in about the year 595, Muhammad married Khadija. I hope I'm pronouncing it right. A wealthy 40-year-old widow. Their union produced daughters, but no sons. By all accounts, Muhammad was a faithful husband and a good father. He also had a reputation as being an honest businessman, and apparently he managed his wife's business in trade very well and grew prosperous. Muhammad was a man who was evidently given to deep religious feelings. He often retreated to a cave near Mecca to meditate. On his numerous trading expeditions, he came in contact with some Christians and a great many Jews. The nearby town of Yathrib had several Jewish communities, and at this time, most Arabs were polytheistic. Now, up to age 40, there was nothing about Muhammad that that would seem to suggest he was in any way remarkable. But at the age of 40, he reported that he began to experience visions. Now, per Islamic tradition, the angel Gabriel first revealed to him that he was to be God's prophet. I find interesting that part of Islamic lore that it's well established that Muhammad confided these visions only to his wife, Khadija, and he was plagued by self-doubt about what this was all about. He questioned whether he could really be a prophet of God, but he came to be convinced that he was. In about the year 613, he began to preach openly, and he slowly gained converts. Muhammad is known to history to have been illiterate, as very likely was Jesus. But unlike Jesus, at least some of the words coming from Muhammad were written down during his lifetime. Now, to a Muslim, it's blasphemy to suggest that the words which were collected together into the Quran came from a source other than God, with Muhammad merely serving as God's messenger. No one disputes that the Quran contains some of the finest prose in literature. At first, Muhammad preached only to a circle of friends and relatives. Total submission to God was required for his teaching, and submission in Arabic is Islam, which was the name of the new religion. It was rooted in texts and traditions of the Jews, which is a very interesting state of affairs, given the current standing in the Middle East and what people understand about or misunderstand about Islam. The first teachings of the religion were modest, but Muhammad's message, as he kept at it, began to arouse some opposition. Meccans saw this new movement, based upon views originating in the Judeo-Christian Bible, as a danger. It was liable to cut into the lucrative cult of the Kaaba, which was a sanctuary in Mecca that contained a pantheon of gods visited by nomads passing through. As more and more of what Muhammad produced was collected, it was stated forcefully that this was the last and final divine revelation that had begun with the prophets of the Old Testament. Islam proclaimed that God's name was Allah and that there were no other gods. Allah was, however, very definitely the same God of the Jews and Christians. Muslims were taught to respect Jews and Christians as people of the book. Muhammad, like Jesus, was less than a complete success as a preacher in his hometown. He did have an influential uncle who apparently acted to shield him from Meccan forces of opposition, but by 622, the threat to him was such that he had to flee to Yathrib, better known today as Medina. Muslims date their calendar to this flight or hijra to the city of Medina from Mecca. In Medina, Muhammad attracted many more followers. He apparently had contracts to act as an arbiter among various tribes there, and the Jews that were there apparently joined him in some numbers, although most apparently decided that his new revelations were something that was too different from their faith. Muhammad moved from being an arbiter to the ruler of Medina, and over the next few years, Medina and Mecca clashed and eventually went to war. Now, as we started out saying in the beginning of this, a role as a military leader was thrust upon Muhammad, and he led his forces. He led the forces of Medina into war against Mecca. In one battle, he was wounded. He apparently was a pretty good field general. He learned from his mistakes, and he proved to be very skillful at negotiations. By 630, mainly through negotiations, the Meccans decided to submit to Islam without any further warfare. Muhammad returned to the place of his birth in triumph as a conqueror. The Kaaba was in fact turned into a Muslim sanctuary, which it remains to this day, and for the next 2.5 years until he died, the surrounding region in Arabia was consolidated under his leadership and under Islam. Now, the centers of civilization that we're perhaps more familiar with from the history books in nearby Persia, which at that time was a Persian empire under the Sassanid leaders, and in Constantinople, which was what Rome had become under Byzantine leadership. Although we in the West think of Rome as falling in the 400s, Roman civilization really lasted pretty much intact until the 1400s in Constantinople. Leaders of both the Roman and Persian empires were advised to convert to Islam by Muhammad. He sent messages to them, but they thought it both decided it would be best to ignore this this upstart from backwater Arabia. By the time he died in 622, Muhammad ruled all of southern Arabia, and he was followed by capable successors called caliphs. The Bedouin tribesmen of Arabia were now united. They had a new religion to inspire them, and this small army of Arabs embarked upon a very successful campaign of conquest under Caliphs Abu Bakr and Omar ibn al-Khattab. Now, Omar is virtually unknown in the West, but is himself a very influential person in world history. For example, Hart ranked him number 52, far ahead of much better known figures as Charlemagne and Julius Caesar. By the year 642, just 20 years after Muhammad's death, Egypt, Syria, and Palestine had all been wrested from the Byzantines, and the mainly Christian areas there were to become mainly Muslim, which they still are today. The Mesopotamian era, which is today's Iraq, as well as the Persian Sassanid Empire, fell to Arab conquest, and by the year 711, Arab armies, inspired by the prophet, had swept across North Africa and entered Spain. I think it's worth mentioning, as we're trying to sort of clear the air here on issues about Islam and Muhammad, that in the Muslim empires, Christians and Jews were left undisturbed for the most part. They fared very well under Muslim rule, much better than Muslims would later do under Christian rule. And in spite of Christian writings that were critical of Muslim civilization, people thrived under this system of religious doctrines and law that stressed fairness and ethics and conversions to Islam often came about because it was seen as a favorable system of worship. Now, being a departure from accepted dogma made Islam regarded as a heresy by Christians. Muslims, for their part, believed that Jews and Christians erred due to the lack of the final clarification of divine will. Western civilization owes a great debt to these great Muslim empires between the time of Muhammad and basically the Renaissance. The Quran said that the ink of the scholar is to be more revered than the blood of the martyr. And under Muslim civilizations, many of the manuscripts of ancient Greece and Rome were carefully preserved, and in some cases, only the Arabic translations have survived to the present. It's been a great slander of history that when Omar came to Egypt in 642, he ordered the great library of the ancient world in Alexandria to be burned. In fact, it turns out the mighty library, which once held 700,000 rolls, was destroyed in 391 by Christians fighting during a civil war involving the Emperor Aurelian. It was Christianity which took on a much more activist role in eliminating ancient thought. The Catholic Byzantine Emperor, for example, closed Plato's Academy after 8 centuries of operation. Education from sources outside the church pretty much came to the end during the Middle Ages. And the other great loss of ancient learning came with the sack of Constantinople, not by Muslim Turks in 1453, but by Catholic Venetians in 1204 during the Fourth Crusade, an effort to stamp out religious heresy in the Holy Land. So in the end, and I didn't intend to get this long-winded on the subject, but in the end, it's wrong for Christian churchmen to slander Muhammad and Islam. Muhammad was not a terrorist. Islam is no more characterizable as a religion of violence than is Judaism or Christianity. Moses, Joshua, and King David led forces of conquest. They were not terrorists. A strong case for terrorism could be made for Richard the Lionhearted, Cortez, Pizarro, and the forces of the Spanish Inquisition. No less an authority than Pope John Paul II said that Catholics should speak out some years back against many forms of violence perpetrated in the names of faith, wars of religion, tribunals of the Inquisition, and other forms of violations of the rights of persons. At this time, I think it's an especially good time not to single out perceived Islamic shortcomings. Jesus asked those who were about to stone a woman to death to let he who was without sin cast the first stone. When we examine more recent examples of the conquest of the New World, for example, by Catholic Spain, we have to see that was as bloodthirsty and venal as any conquest in history. And we don't look down upon people of the Catholic faith on account of it. I'm not a Muslim, but I've traveled in Muslim Egypt, Turkey, Jordan, Syria, Indonesia, and Malaysia. I found people there to be as helpful and kind as in Christian nations. And frankly, I think it's terrible that I have to point this out to people in America. But with bigots like Falwell out there, more people may have to state what is the obvious. I know of no reasonable comparison between the founder of Islam and the men who are currently interested in attacking the United States for perceived evil actions in the Middle East. This is like blaming what Tim McVeigh did to the Murrah building in Oklahoma City in retribution for the siege on Waco on Jesus. What people do in the name of a religion cannot be blamed necessarily on the belief system itself. Their interpretation may be the problem. So I certainly hope we have no more such nonsense coming out of Reverend Falwell and others. We'd like to thank White House spokesman Uri Fleischman as well as KDVS's own Dr. Andy Jones for their contributions to this show. Tune in again next Thursday at 5 o'clock at 90.3 FM. And please stay tuned on your dial for Gina to follow with Electricity and Lust, her most eclectic mix of music for your listening pleasure. I am Douglas Everett. We'll see you next week.